From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Donald Trump laid out his plans for the economy in Detroit today. In a speech at the Detroit Economic Club, the Republican nominee for president called for major tax cuts, a temporary moratorium on regulations, and renegotiations of trade deals like NAFTA and the TPP. And he argued why those trade deals and other economic policies of the past have been bad for the U.S.
When we abandoned the policy of America first, we started rebuilding other countries instead of our own. The skyscrapers went up in Beijing and many other cities around the world, while the factories and neighborhoods crumbled right here in Detroit.
For more, let's bring in NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And one of the things people may have noticed when they heard that little clip there is that he was on a script today. He was on a script. He was actually interrupted several times by protesters, but kept his cool, unlike what he's done in the past when he's gone after the people who've started talking in the middle of his speech.
This was a speech to the Detroit Economic Club, and that is a venue honored in time and history as a serious place to talk policy. And so it was a scripted speech, and he did try to stick with it and not to react to the protesters other than to say thank you and acknowledge the applause of the crowd as the people were taken out. There were more than a dozen of those interruptions. But he did, as you say, keep his cool, stay with his message, and talk about economics.
And did he give enough specifics to satisfy critics who have said he has not been telling us exactly how he's going to implement his policies?
Not to satisfy critics in all likelihood, but perhaps enough to satisfy the people he was really aiming at. And that would be the people he wants to have thinking that with his proposals, most of which are described primarily in terms of what he imagines to be their effects, as opposed to the mechanics of how it would get done or the specifics of how it would relate to existing policy. Let me give you an example. He says that he's going to eliminate the carried interest of special handling for people who handle hedge funds. And he then stopped and said, and that's going to make a lot of my guys really mad at me. And remember, he appointed a group of economic advisors that included quite a few hedge fund managers, other investment bankers, 13 men who basically are very much in his world. And he said, that's going to make them mad at me. Well, the fact is he's also proposing that we reduce the business tax rate from 35% nominal top tax rate, which actually nobody pays, down to something like 15%. And when you do that, then the carried interest handling of these men's income is no longer attractive in the same way. So it's really kind of a wash in that regard. And most of the things he's proposing are actually very, very good for the wealthiest.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what he said about taxes.
I am proposing an across-the-board income tax reduction, especially for middle-income Americans. This will lead to millions of new and really good-paying jobs. The rich will pay their fair share, but no one will pay so much that it destroys jobs or undermines our ability as a nation to compete.
One of the other things that Trump said, Ron, is he reiterated his call for repealing and replacing Obamacare and said that doing so would save millions of jobs. Have the fact checkers looked at that, and what are they saying?
It's not clear what his source was on the millions of jobs. It has been part of the critique of Obamacare that some employers hired fewer people because of Obamacare or tried to hold down their enrollment of employees because of Obamacare. But that is very much a matter in some dispute. I would like to say one other thing about that fair share of taxes.
Yeah.
There was no point in the speech where Donald Trump explicitly said that a fair share of taxes would be more than they're paying now. So it's conceivable he means that their fair of taxes is conceivably even less or certainly not greater than what it is now. And we don't know what he considers a fair share of the overall tax burden in particular because we don't get to see and have never seen his tax returns. He refuses to release them.
Did he do enough to reverse what was happening in the campaign in the last week? He was in a fight with the Gold Star family. His poll numbers were just dropping. Hillary Clinton in a number of recent polls has been up by double digits and up in red states like Georgia.
He did change the subject, and he effectively got everybody talking about today's speech slash pep rally there in Detroit. And people are going to be dissecting this all week long and listening to Hillary Clinton's comeback on Thursday. That's different from last week. It should be better for him.
That's NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, once again, the Olympians are dazzling, and it's not just the nearly 5,000 crystals in every one of the leotards worn by the U.S. women's gymnastics team. Lots of drama there, by the way. Simone Biles and Ali Raisman qualified to advance to the all-around final, while Gabby Douglas, who won the gold medal in London, just missed a chance to defend her title. There were other gasp-inducing moments. French gymnast Samir Ait Said broke his leg during a vault. Dutch cyclist Annemiek van Vleuten was seriously hurt after she flew over her handlebars during a steep descent in the women's road race. And Venus and Serena Williams and number one seed Novak Djokovic are out of tennis competition after just one round. But let's spend a few minutes on swimming. Nicole Auerbach covers Olympic swimming for USA Today. She's joining us from the Olympic Village in Rio by Skype. And Nicole, start with Katie Ledecky winning gold last night, but more to the point, how she won it. Describe.
Well, I think, you know, I've seen her do this for the last 3 years, but I don't think that the national or international audience is all that familiar with her. So it's so visual to watch the way that she wins these races, particularly at the 400 freestyle distance, which is what she won Sunday night, but also she'll compete in the 800 later this week. And she just gets such a huge lead that she is finishing and celebrating before other swimmers even touch the wall. So she's shattering her own world records at this point. The crowd just swells as you're watching the splits come in. And basically by the halfway point, everyone knew that she wanted to break it and she was going to break this world record. So it's just a matter of how much she does it by. And it was about 2 seconds.
Is she the female Michael Phelps who won his 19th gold medal in his fifth Olympic Games last night with the relay? Is she him?
Well, you know, honestly, talking to people around the swimming community, she may be even more dominant than Michael was at his heyday right now, just because of her versatility, because she is swimming every distance in freestyle. She is swimming from the 100. She did the women's 4x100 meter relay and all the way up to the 800, which is the furthest that women can swim in the Olympics. That is unheard of. Women and men swimmers, you specialize. You are a sprinter. You are distance. You are butterfly. You are breaststroke. Mm-hmm. Or like Michael Phelps was an IMer. He did a lot of different things. But he didn't win by the margins that Katie is in some of these races. Mm-hmm. So by some in the swimming community, she is even more dominant than he was at his peak. And she could certainly pile up a lot of medals over these years. She's only 19 right now, and she's certainly got a lot of years left.
Yeah. Well, and talk about one little just aspect of the swimming. There seems to be some sort of beef between America's Lily King and a Russian swimmer. What's going on here?
Well, obviously one of the storylines coming into the Olympics was the Russian doping scandal and whether or not Russian athletes would be able to compete in the Olympics. And there were some swimmers that had failed drug tests. Yulia Efimova is one of them. She has been twice suspended for use of banned substances. And suddenly she was listed on the heat sheet and competing in the Olympics over the weekend. It was very kind of sneakily under the radar, quietly added. And she is in the 100 breaststroke. She's the second qualifier heading into tonight's finals behind American Lily King. And, you know, she's in a position to medal. She's in a position to potentially take away a medal from someone who has never failed a drug test before, not to mention two. So Lily King saw Yulia Efimova win her heat in the semifinals Sunday night right before her. And she made some sort of gesture about, you know, being number one or something like that. And Lily King gave her a Dikembe Mutombo, you know, wag in the ready room.
A finger wag?
Yes, a finger wag, like no way. And then she was talking about afterwards that she is not a fan of someone who is a drug cheat. And she doubled down on that. And it's been very interesting. We've had a couple comments and war with words with some swimmers who have failed drug tests in the past. Sun Yang is one, and Mac Horton, an Australian swimmer, has kind of also stirred the pot a little bit, poking at him. And so it's just very interesting. And it sort of added an extra layer to the women's 100 breaststroke tonight, just because, you know, you have all this tension every time Efimova and some of these Russian swimmers are in the pool. They are getting booed by the Brazilian crowd. People are not happy that certain people are competing here. So, you know, the crowd will certainly be behind Lily King, and so will a lot of Americans at home, based on my Twitter mentions last night. So I think it added a different dimension, sort of a good versus evil, you know, someone who's been found to have doped in the past versus a 19-year-old who's a swimmer at Indiana. It's just kind of adds a completely different, you know, layer to this race.
Nicole, just tell us quickly, what should we watch for this week?
Well, I'm most fascinated. Speaking of Katie Ledecky, we've talked about her. She's got the 200-meter freestyle. She's in qualifying with that today, and then tomorrow night will be the final. She swam the fastest time in the world in that event this year, but this is a relatively new addition for her. She's kind of going down the distances, and this is one that she does not currently own the world record in. She owns the 400, the 800, and the 1500. I don't know the last time someone has held those three plus the 200 world record all at the same time, but she certainly could do that, and we might be able to see that this week in Rio.
Nicole Auerbach, lucky woman. She's in Rio and the Media Village covering Olympic swimming for USA Today. Nicole, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And if you're looking for a great summer film for teens on up, John Carney's Sing Street is now available on DVD, on demand, and streaming. It's his look at his own youth in 1980s Dublin, a city devastated by recession and dazzled by the new sensation, music videos. First-time actor Ferdier Walsh-Pilo plays Connor, struggling with his parents' imploding marriage, a transfer to a rough Catholic school, and longings for a mysterious girl. How will he win her? Well, of course, he'll form a band that stinks at first and then gets pretty good. This is your life. You can't go anywhere. You gotta grab the wheel and own it. Drive it like you stole it. That's Drive It Like You Stole It from the film Sing Street. We spoke a while ago with both writer-director John Carney and his star, but let's start with Carney. We asked, when he was Connor's age, did he have a band?
I was in a series of very bad bands when I was that age.
They all have to be bad.
I guess the difference between this film is that I made a decision that this band would be a good band because I think that there's enough bad school bands.
Right. Well, it's pretty bad to start, but it's responding to so many things. Start with the videos.
Before we had MTV in Ireland, we had Top of the Pops, which was a British show. We would sit around the television. And it was, you know, cross generations. My grandmother would be there, my mother, myself, and we would be watching Simon Le Bon videos.
Duran Duran.
Yeah, it was an amazing time because everybody's attention was sort of taken by these crazy songs and these brilliant videos.
We have these wonderful scenes in which the entire family gathers as if they're watching Fire for the first time. And here Connor again, Ferdia Walsh-Pilo, and his brother Brendan, played by the terrific Jack Rayner, are watching Duran Duran's Rio. Brendan loves it, but their father Robert, played by Aidan Gillen, just can't quite get it. Let's listen.
I mean, why can't they get them to play live? What are they trying to hide?
It's because they're in the USA. Did you not hear them?
And this lasts forever. It's the perfect mixture of music and visuals. It's short, to the point. Look at it. I mean, what tyranny could stand up to that?
Just thrilling. I mean, it's just a thrilling moment. What was it like? What did it do for your heart to put that together?
I remember going and filming those sequences every day and sort of feeling like a family again, a feeling that that was sort of the television really in Ireland really was, as you say, and looking at the fire is a great way of sort of the television did become the fireplace of, you know, famine era Ireland or, you know, where families would sit and around in the fireplace. It was the TV and that was what sort of grabbed your attention. But there was a great sense of sort of event and there was a great sense of sort of family and coziness and making, you know, put the tea on and let's watch all these kind of, you know, exotic locations on TV because these people were making these videos for the first time and were given, I mean, the way those videos got made is just fascinating in the 80s. It really was sort of brown envelopes full of money and record labels telling guys, you know, go off to the Bahamas, here's 80 grand and, you know, come back with a video, come back with a 3-minute film for help selling this song. Another reason why the families were gathered around the TV screen in this way was because things were hard. My memory of Dublin in the 80s was constantly grey. We had an occasional summer where the sun shone for a couple of days, but generally my memory of it is that it was grey and it was bleak and it was cold and I didn't have gloves and I was too fashion conscious to wear a hat on my bicycle so my ears were freezing. And, you know, my bicycle was made up of bits of other people's bicycle because we couldn't afford to buy a new bicycle. Mm-hmm. And these videos were sort of kind of, it's almost like they were, for me and for our generation, what sort of great movie musicals like Busley Berkeley movies must have been for Americans in the sort of the, you know, the golden era of Hollywood musicals. They were sheer escapism. They were technicolor. They had girls in them, which was a huge thing. Mm-hmm. They were uncensored. The very opposite of Irish television and what Irish television, which was still sort of kind of run by this church in a sense.
Yeah. You say, you know, things were run by the churches, as were the public schools. And it was a pretty rough one that your character, and I'm imagining you, ended up in, because I hear you also had to leave a private and go to a public school. Connor transfers to Sing Street, the Catholic school. There is one. And it has a run-in with one of the priests because he's wearing the wrong color shoes. Let's listen.
I bought these before I knew about the shoe colour policy here at Sing Street. But it's not as if they're runners or something. They're brown. They're quite sensible.
They're not black.
I'm not sure what you want me to do.
Take them off. You can leave them at the door there. Seeing as you're so fond of them, you can pick them up here at 4 o'clock every day until you comply with the rules of the school.
Well, that was the least of what happened at the school. I mean, there was abuse. Did this happen to you?
The scene with the brown shoes happened to me. I got beaten up by a teacher for not wearing black shoes, which were part of the uniform of the school.
Physically beaten up?
Physically beaten up, yeah. I got dragged down and thumped a couple of times by a teacher for wearing brown shoes, which I found particularly... I really... Kids have an enormous sense of injustice. And I really couldn't understand the idea of a color of shoe over another color. And I remember screaming, you know, they're not runners. They're not orange runners, or they're not white, or they're not, you know, they are shoes. They're responsible. And he just couldn't see past the idea of the rule being broken.
Right. So how much maybe revenge was it for you in this film to have your character sing a song called Brown Shoes? We're going to listen to a little of it. When he just completely disses the school, I mean, you get to talk to your character at a person from your past.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of wish fulfillment in the film, and there's a lot of, you know, I have to be honest, it is still it's a fantasy movie, and it is a film where I get to do many of the things that I didn't have the courage to do at the time. So there's a fun element of sort of, you know, finally sort of 30 years later getting my own back on these guys.
So who the hell are you? Tell me what to do. You wear a dress and tell me not to wear brown shoes. Do you think it matters?
That's Sing Street, writer and director John Carney, his film now out on DVD, on demand, and streaming. And it stars 14-year-old Ferdia Walsh-Pilo, playing Connor, or Cosmo as he calls himself, who persuades an aspiring model, played by Lucy Boynton, to star in a waterside music video, and she jumps right in.
Can you really not swim?
No.
So why'd you do that then?
For our art, Cosmo. You can never do anything by half.
We spoke with then 16-year-old Ferdia Walsh-Pilo last spring. He's a former boy soprano who'd performed opera and formed a band with his mates when he was 11, but his knowledge of 80s music was non-existent.
I hadn't quite got around to the 80s yet. I was playing lots of different kinds of music, and I was sort of in the 60s when I was about to do Sing Street, kind of music-wise and fashion-wise, and I was playing with a band, and we were playing lots of skiffle music and kind of
really?
That kind of vibe. Yeah, I mean, well, it wasn't very good skiffle music, but it was...
But still, I mean, that would have been... When was that? That would have been in the aughts. I mean, that was...
Yeah.
And so you were going back almost half a century already.
Absolutely, yeah. I definitely wasn't playing pop music. I was really influenced by kind of... music from Tennessee and stuff, kind of skiffly country music, not very country, I don't like to say bluegrass, a bit more bluegrass, but I mean, it was just that's where I was kind of being inspired, and I mean, I just had to kind of skip a few generations and learn about the
real
80s
fast.
For this film really fast.
Well, let's listen to the first song that your character writes. We mentioned that there was a young woman, and this is called The Riddle of the Model.
She's standing on the corner like an angel in disguise. As I look a little closer, she's got dangerous eyes. She tells me she's a model of international reputation. She's lacking in a bottle, but there's a stipulation.
Well, what about all this, you know, the Cure, Duran Duran, Hall & Oates are, you know, featured. There's almost a montage where you come to school every day, we see you around the corner, and you're a different persona.
Yes.
Oh, look, he's Boy George today.
Yeah.
So who's telling you about all of this? Who's It just feels like you're taking a walk through musical history while you were doing this.
Yes, I mean, it absolutely was. It was a huge learning curve. John was always sending me over music videos and things like that. But yeah, those bits are great, actually, because it's like a more extreme version of what actually goes on in school, because I know I was definitely doing that in school. I was definitely coming in like every few days with a different haircut or different hairstyle.
Who were you? What were you imitating?
I was probably going down the route of like John Lennon, you know, or, you know, young John Lennon, which is just basically Elvis inspired, just like leather jackets, greased back hair. You know, I looked awful, but it was just all part of finding who you are and finding your own thing. And that's what the film is about as well. It's about Connor finding who he is and finding his own voice. And it's really interesting because, especially in the 80s, it was so... That happened a lot more because it was so extreme, pop music, and there's so much stuff going on and so much... It was the first time people kind of tackled the thing of kind of guys wearing makeup, and first time people challenged the whole kind of sexuality thing and everything. And the boots on the other foot now, buckle up.
Again, you're only 16.
Yeah.
At 14 when you do this, it's still quite something. But the director, John Carney, John Carney says that one of the tricks of directing young people is he can't say to you, well, you know, remember how you felt when you had that big breakup?
Yeah.
Because at 14, had you had one yet?
He did say stuff to me, like, one stage he was like, you know, like you're chatting up a girl at the bar. Just chat to her like that. And I was, John, how many times have I chatted up a girl at a bar?
14.
Yeah. But it was, you know, you can get what he means by that. Yeah. We've all felt love in some way, you know, not necessarily towards another girl, but, you know, you can imagine what it can feel like. And it's just, yeah.
That's Sing Street star Ferdia Walsh-Pilo. It is a wonderful film. It's a wonderful film. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Actor Ferdia Walsh-Pilo, his film Sing Street is now out on DVD, on demand, and streaming. It's Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. When you cook with fresh, high-quality ingredients, you can tell. Blue Apron creates and delivers pre-proportioned meals with easy step-by-step instructions, all made in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create home-cooked meals. That's blueapron.com/here. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
And tomorrow, the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, is facing a primary in Wisconsin. His opponent is businessman Paul Neelan, who got some praise on Twitter from Donald Trump before Trump decided to endorse Ryan. Joining us for more is reporter Marty Michelson of Milwaukee Public Radio, part of our Contributors Network. Marty, how worried is Paul Ryan?
Well, he is taking the race seriously. He has been spending money in his district, and he has been running TV ads. In fact, he has spent $600,000 on TV ads in this race just in the past month.
And tell us about Paul Neelan, his opponent in this race.
Well, Paul Neelan is a business executive. He moved to the district 2 years ago. He announced his bid for the congressional seat earlier this year. It went largely unnoticed, very little fanfare. It appeared to be token opposition. But the race heated up in the past week when GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump initially refused to endorse Ryan. Neelan, who has an allegiance to Donald Trump, seized the opportunity and began attacking Ryan on national talk shows, including Fox News. Trade is a big issue in the race, and Paul Neelan was saying that Paul Ryan's policies on trade have hurt American workers.
Well, let's take a listen to a little bit of these attacks you're talking about. Neelan has been very aggressive against Paul Ryan. Here he is on Fox with Lou Dobbs.
Paul Ryan's negotiated the worst trade deal in our lifetime. It gives up U.S. sovereignty. It gives our jobs away. And people are tired of this globalist, this soulless globalist agenda of sucking America dry and sending our jobs overseas.
Now, Marty, Paul Neelan has gotten into trouble with some comments about Muslims. Now, of course, we know that Donald Trump has supported a ban on people coming from countries with terrorist ties. Earlier, it was a ban on all Muslims coming into the United States. Neelan went even further and said that he supported deporting Muslims who are already in the United States. He's since stepped back from that. But what do we know about his positions?
He definitely has some fighting words to say in this race. He is painting himself as alt-conservative or alt-right, as he calls it, meaning he is the alternative conservative in the race. And he did go on to call Ryan the most open border member of Congress. So immigration and terrorism also are issues in the race. Ryan then dismissed Neelan's comments last week on a radio show in Green Bay, but he is also running a TV ad counter to Paul Neelan's remarks.
Let's listen here to a Ryan ad focusing on national security.
The United States is an exceptional nation. Every one of us has the opportunity to live, work, and worship as we see fit. That's freedom. People around the world dream of it. But attacks have shown us that terrorists want to destroy our freedom and security.
Any polling at this point, Marty?
Yes, there has been some limited polling. A couple of polls have shown that Paul Ryan is not in trouble. In fact, he is garnering 70% of the vote or more at this point.
Well, we'll be watching as this primary takes place in Wisconsin tomorrow. Marty Michelson, reporter with Milwaukee Public Radio, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
I've noticed an annoying trend. Maybe you have too. You buy something, maybe online, maybe at a store, and they ask for your email address. And then the next day, you get an email asking you to review your purchase. Could be clothes, could be a hotel stay. How'd you like it? And if you don't respond, another one. We noticed you haven't responded, but we would really like to know what you thought of your purchase. So what's going on? Phil Fernbach is an assistant professor at the Leeds School of Business at the University of Colorado Boulder, and he's studied online ratings and reviews. He joins us. Welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
So why am I getting all these emails asking me to review things that I've already purchased?
Well, there's definitely a couple things going on. One thing is when consumers go online nowadays, reviews and ratings are definitely one of the most important sources of information they look at. And one thing we found in our research is that when people see a large number of ratings, they treat that as informative about the quality of a product. So they see a large number of ratings, they actually think it's a higher quality product.
Even if some of those ratings are bad?
Absolutely. So people really pay a lot of attention to them, give them much more trust than they actually deserve.
But let me give you an example here.
Sure.
Because recently
sure.
I took my car in because there was a crack in the front windshield and I went to mm-hmm. Safelite and I got it replaced. And within a couple of days, I got a request on email asking me to review how they did. And then I didn't respond because I don't have time and I don't care. And I got it replaced and that's that. And I paid for it and it's over. And then the next thing you know, I get another one saying, a reminder, please go and review it. And then after that, another one, a third one saying, please review it. And it really makes me wonder, how badly do they want this review?
Yeah, I mean, there's very little cost for them to send out an email. And there's quite a bit of incentive for them to get people to evaluate these things. Typically, evaluations online tend to be quite high. So chances are you're not going to go on there and give a bad evaluation. A lot of websites also use an algorithm to try to determine the way that they sort product options. And a lot of the times those algorithms will take into account how many times people have reviewed a product. So there's a bunch of different forces that sort of go together to really incentivize companies to want you to go on and evaluate things.
But when you say that these reviews really matter and that they want other people to see that they have a lot of reviews, even if those reviews mm-hmm. aren't great, how much do they matter compared to all the other things that companies use to advertise their products?
That's a great question. So if you look back before the age of the internet, how people got product information, what kind of information they used to make inferences about the quality of products, the major things were variables that were under control of marketers, like the price that you pay. People very strongly believe that a higher priced product indicates a higher quality product. They looked very strongly at the brand name and so on. And those things still matter. But when people are on Amazon.com or other websites and they see that star rating, that thing sort of drowns out everything else. It's really, in our studies, we find it's the most powerful predictor of the quality inferences that people draw. The sort of other side of the story is that it turns out that that average rating is really not that predictive of the quality of the product. So there's been created this situation where people really overestimate the validity of these things. But they really do exert a huge influence on people's decision making.
Do you think that'll last, or do you think people will eventually catch on to what you're saying, that the reviews aren't necessarily indicative of how the product is?
You know, that's a great question, too. In my experience in describing our results to people, they say, wow, I see all your data and I really believe it, but I just still trust these things. There seems to be this very powerful sort of mental connection that we see between that average star rating and quality. And sort of you point out to people all of the different flaws in these things. You know, there's fake reviews, there's randomness, there's consumers who just really don't know how to properly evaluate more technical kind of products. All these things add up. But when people see that average, they just go with it.
So at this point, what should a consumer do? Should they use some other measure to decide which product to buy?
Yeah, we definitely don't advocate for completely ignoring reviews. There is some quality information in there, in the ratings. It's just not nearly as much as people think it is. Another thing that people do is they tend to ignore the sample size. So if you only see 20 ratings, it's probably not enough to really know that this product is a 4.5. It could be a 3.8 or something like that. So people should really not completely ignore them, but they should scale back how much they rely on them. One thing we really looked at in terms of trying to understand the quality information is evaluations by experts like people at Consumer Reports, who really have been doing scientific product testing for many, many years. And so that's another thing that people can do. Try to look for more expert evaluations, especially for more technical product categories where the experts are doing the sort of scientific side-by-side tests that your average consumer can't really do.
Brings up another point, which is unrelated and yet also kind of related, which is after I buy something, let's say I go and buy some bowls, and the next thing I know, I'm being advertised these very bowls that I already bought on my Twitter feed or wherever. And why does that happen? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. This is the most fast-growing area of marketing right now. Analytics and data analysis, where companies are using information that they have about you, either sort of demographic information or it could be online behavior, your purchases, all of that kind of stuff, to build up some kind of a model that predicts how you're going to respond to different kinds of offerings and things like that. And so companies are getting much, much better at targeting consumers specifically with things that they're likely to click on and maybe buy.
Even now, if they've already bought those things.
Yeah, so your example indicates that these models are not perfect. You know, they're getting better, but they're not perfect. So they make kind of silly mistakes all the time.
But it's still worth it for them to send that out just in case I haven't bought it yet. They're better off annoying me with something than not telling me to buy something that I might still want to buy.
Well, you know, there is a line there. If they annoy you too much, that's probably a bad thing. You're going to maybe not want to go to that website again, or you know, you might just get frustrated and be less likely to buy. But, you know, when people are putting an ad on the internet, they're not expecting 50% of people to click through to that. You know, they're expecting 1% of people to click through. And if they can increase the number of eyeballs that actually look at that ad and they get 1.1% to click through in a sort of aggregate way, that can really add up.
And speaking of annoying people, let's go back to our original question. Is there anything that I can do as a consumer to stop getting emails after I've already bought something to review the product, because I'm not going to do it?
Yeah, that's a tough one. So on a site-by-site basis, there might be ways to opt out. But in general, people should just get used to the new world, I think, that we're living in, which is that marketers have a lot of information about you, and you're going to get a lot more targeted kind of responses and product offerings and those kind of things. But it's going to be hard unless you sort of go dark and go off the grid to escape from this new world that we live in.
That's Phil Fernbach, an assistant professor at the Leeds School of Business at the University of Colorado Boulder. Phil, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And now, a sorrowful update. In January, we brought you a story about a group of Arizona pilots that volunteers to fly blood to hospitals in remote parts of the state. Well, one of the pilots featured died last week in a plane crash during such a delivery. From member station KJZZ in Phoenix, Stina Sieg has this remembrance.
Whenever anyone asked Mac McClure why he delivered blood throughout Arizona for the group Flights for Life, he always had the same answer.
We save lives. It's the only reason I fly blood.
When McClure's small plane went down in the woods of northern Arizona August 2nd, the 76-year-old pilot was on his 887th blood delivery in a decade.
It was 100% with him.
Jerry Kapp, a fellow Flights for Life pilot, says McClure was the face of the organization, and not just because he was their president.
He was loved by everybody.
Sue Thu, a spokeswoman for United Blood Services of Arizona, remembers when McClure was given an award for his work with Flights for Life. Thu says McClure was adamant he wouldn't be in a photo alone, saying the whole group deserved the honor.
He wasn't the kind of guy who wanted to take the credit for anything. He wanted to be part of a team that did something wonderful for the community.
Thu says every year the group delivers enough blood for 20,000 transfusions. Transfusions that have helped save people, like Scott Tipton, a former Phoenix area police officer with a rare blood type, who was shot 7 times after responding to a domestic violence call. When McClure was interviewed back in late 2015, it was clear how proud he was of being able to help people.
And if you ever need it, I hope you never do, then we will be there.
Not long before Mac McClure died, he helped Flights for Life expand beyond Arizona to bring much-needed blood to isolated parts of New Mexico and Texas. For Here and Now, I'm Stina Sieg in Phoenix.
New York Senator Chuck Schumer is calling on Congress to cut its summer recess short to come back and fund the fight against Zika. Schumer says a vaccine could be delayed because Congress has not yet approved a bill that would provide nearly $2 billion to fight the disease. Meanwhile, the Zika risk is growing in South Florida. Last week, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued an unprecedented travel warning, telling pregnant women to stay away from areas around Miami where Zika is spreading. Well, this is just one of the public health crises the CDC has dealt with in its 70 years of existence. And that high-stakes work has captured the imagination of TV writers and filmmakers. Sean Powers from Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting takes us through a brief history of a government institute turned Hollywood star.
Now, I may be an alarmist. I may be entirely wrong about the whole matter, but I've seen this disease work. And I'm telling you, if it ever gets loose, it can spread over the entire country.
That's actor Richard Widmark as Dr. Clint Reed, the main character in the 1950 film noir Panic in the Streets, one of the first movies to feature an agency like the CDC.
Pneumonic plague is the pulmonary form of bubonic, the Black Death of the Middle Ages, and its death incidence is practically 100%.
What did you say he was?
Well, an expert on the plague won't help us now. What we need is an expert on movies.
My name is Stephen Brown. I am chief film critic for SilverScreenCapture.com.
Stephen lives in Atlanta and reviews movies as a hobby on his website. I asked him to compile a list of some of the classics inspired by the CDC.
In various forms over the years, in cinema culture, CDC has become less a specific government organization than a state of mind. There's always been intrepid scientists trying to look for ways to fight against time, fight against the virus, fight against the pod people.
No wonder they didn't bleed. It's clotted throughout the entire system. 5 quarts of blood turned to powder.
In theory, I suppose a single organism could do it.
But in fact, there isn't an organism on Earth.
You mean there didn't used to be?
That's a scene from the 1971 sci-fi thriller The Andromeda Strain, based on the novel by Michael Crichton. A team of scientists tries to stop a deadly alien virus that wipes out a small town. Stephen Brown says in these earlier films that tackle CDC-esque issues, you don't hear CDC mentioned by name.
Only in the past 2 or 3 decades has the CDC actually been called out as something that people discuss and talk about as an entity, shorthand for the disease-fighting warriors.
And no one represents disease-fighting warriors better than our brain-bashing, skull-crushing heroes in The Walking Dead. The show features an episode at the CDC where a lone researcher tries to learn more about what's turned humanity into bloodthirsty zombies. One of the main characters finds out the key to the outbreak.
At the CDC, Jenner told me, whatever it is, we all carry it.
In recent years, zombie flicks like World War Z, I Am Legend, and 28 Days Later have mixed together the undead and public health in an end-of-the-world recipe. CDC Museum Director Judy Gant says it's interesting how those depictions resonate with audiences.
We've had people come into the museum and seriously ask, not kids, but adults, seriously ask, where do you keep the zombies? And we have laughed and said, oh, you know, that's just TV. No, you can tell me, where really are the zombies?
But accuracy matters in some plots, like in the 2011 movie Contagion, which was about the race to stop an airborne virus.
Hello?
Hello? Mr. Barnes?
Yes.
This is Dr. Mears from the Centers for Disease Control. I believe... Hi.
The filmmakers behind Contagion talked with the CDC about accuracy.
Yeah, I picked her up at the airport. What's this about?
How are you feeling today?
Pretty cruddy, to be honest. Head is pounding. I probably picked up some sort of bug.
Where are you right now?
I'm on the bus heading to work.
I'd like you to get off immediately.
Wait, what? What's going on?
Other filmmakers give Kate Falb a call. She oversees Hollywood Health and Society at the University of Southern California. Think of it as the link between Hollywood and the CDC.
If you're a half-hour show, you actually have about 22 minutes to tell your entire story. And within that time, you've got people to kill and murders to be solved and love stories to, you know, there's a lot of other stuff going on besides the health information.
But Folb says that doesn't mean health information should take a back seat. Her and her team provide the entertainment industry with accurate and timely information about things like public health research, climate change, and CDC clothing and equipment.
Viewers actually learn a lot about health information through their favorite television programs, and they actually learn this information and believe it more so from popular narrative programs than they do from the news or commercials or PSAs.
And that leaves the question, what will be Hollywood's next public health crisis? Will it be the race to stop the Zika virus or Ebola, or an even greater menace that we haven't dreamed up yet?
We're heading to the CDC. If there's anything left, it's got to be there, don't you think?
For Here and Now, I'm Sean Powers in Atlanta.
Perhaps Zika coming soon to a movie theater near you. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.